Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show all about public lands and the outdoors from the Center for Western Priorities. My name is Aaron Weiss, and congratulations to you for finding our very first podcast episode, coming to you from the shadow of the Rocky Mountains in beautiful Denver, Colorado. We are going to be here every other week or so talking about public lands and energy issues that affect the American West. Our guest this week is pollster Brian Gottlieb. He's the managing director at Purple Insights, a bipartisan polling firm. Brian led our Winning the West polls in three swing states this year. With Election Day right around the corner, we wanted to sit down with him, get a sense of how that polling is playing out across the West and the country. And we will find out why Nevada had to send the world's longest telegram in order to become a state. But first, a quick look at what's making news on our public lands this week. The big story, of course, is the not guilty verdict in the trial of Ammon and Ryan Bundy and five others who were charged with conspiracy in the armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. The verdict was, to put it mildly, stunning, even to defense attorneys. Reaction was swift, much of it focusing on the cognitive dissonance of seven white people getting acquitted in Oregon, while Native American activists are being arrested by the hundreds at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests in North Dakota. One of the most outspoken voices in the wake of that verdict is Jarvis Kennedy, a member of the Burns Paiute Tribal Council. The Malheur Refuge, of course, is located on ancestral Paiute land. Jarvis, thank you very much for joining us here. I'm sorry about these circumstances. First off, what was your reaction when you heard about the jury's verdict?
Well, I was in shock and disbelief and mad, you know. Pissed off, I guess you could say.
You were there at the refuge for much of the standoff. What's your take, both as a resident of Central Oregon and as a member of the Burns Paiute tribe?
Well, to be honest with you, I was just disgusted and what can you say when you have an all white jury, you know, and no minorities on there. Couple Mormons on there, a couple cowboys, a couple hillbillies, you know, of course they're going to stand with their own. And like I said from the beginning, you know, what if we did that? If I, myself, and some Native brothers and sisters did that, we'd be dealt with. We'd be dealt with quick, like the people over there in Dakota, you know, the DAPL situation going on over there, you know. I mean, what can you say? It's a white world.
Do you think there are any possible legal avenues in civil court for any of the damages to traditional tribal lands? Have you even gone down that road yet?
Sir, I don't know what we're going to do yet. Like I said, we just found the verdict yesterday, and we're just dealing with the aftermath of that. And like I said, you know, there's other fights out there for myself and the tribe to go and check out, like the Nestle situation, the DAPL. And that's for all the legality stuff. And like I said, we're going to have to sit down and have our meetings and talk with our lawyers. But, you know, like I said, this tribe is not rich. We don't have a casino. As I don't know if you've been out here, there's nothing but sagebrush and rabbits out here. You know, there's no jobs here as well, so. If there's any lawyers out there and attorneys want to do some pro bono work and want to help out a little 432 member tribe, you know, feel free to give us a call.
Do you see this and the Dakota Access Pipeline fight, as you mentioned, is this a turning point for tribes or for tribal solidarity?
I think so. I mean, look what's going on over there, you know. And look what just happened to us. Yes, we lost our fight with these guys, but they still got to go to Nevada, and hopefully our Nevada peers are a little bit smarter than our Oregon peers here, you know. And can just only hope for the best and expect the worst, like how I do in my daily life. And as for trying to being in solidarity, yes, of course we got to watch each other's back because we're all we have, you know.
One of the jurors in the case gave an interview to the Oregonian in which he said basically, this wasn't a political decision. We didn't necessarily agree with the Bundys politically, but the government just didn't prove a conspiracy to their satisfaction. What do you have to say to the jury today?
Well, first off, they need to clean their ears out and open their eyes and actually see and hear what happened over here. You know, they apparently didn't believe the cops that testified, you know, and all the people over here in Harney County had the story about what happened. We lived through it. You know, there's a difference between telling somebody about what happened and living through it, you know. And they didn't see that. I mean, we didn't, as Native people, we don't know what the word justice means because we never have it. And now the people of Harney County knows what it feels like to be an Indian without having no justice dealt with them for what happened to them as well, you know. But like I said, we just got to get over this and keep moving forward. And the jury just gave them free rein. They could do this anywhere across the United States. Anywhere, wherever they want now, because they'll get away with it. Now, what kind of message does that tell them? Gives them more power, more leeway. You know, I don't believe in a justice system no more.
Well, Jarvis Kennedy of the Burns Paiute tribe talking about the not guilty verdict in the first Bundy trial. It's important to note here, Ammon and Ryan Bundy are not walking free today. They are awaiting trial along with their dad on much more serious charges in Nevada stemming from the standoff at the Bundy Ranch in 2014. That trial is scheduled for next February. Let's bring in Brian Gottlieb. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Brian is managing director at Purple Insights, one of the top polling firms in the country. He's been a Republican pollster and strategist. Now he does bipartisan issue-based research. The Center for Western Priorities brought Brian on board this past spring to lead a series of polls on conservation and energy issues. We call it Winning the West. If you want to follow along with this conversation or geek out on the numbers, you can find a link to the polls in the show notes or go to westernpriorities.org/winningthewest. Brian Gottlieb, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about three Western swing states here, Colorado, Nevada, and Montana. What was the top line in terms of voters and their priorities when it comes to the outdoors?
Well, when it comes to the outdoors, it was crystal clear that voters, and in particular, the swing voters, believe that the outdoors is critical to why they live in the states they live, and they link them directly to the economy and their quality of life. And we saw just incredibly strong results across the board, across all parties and across all three of these states, where over 90% of the sample of respondents agreed that public lands are one of the main contributors to their high quality of life and quality of living in these states, and also a tremendous connection between the public lands themselves and the economy in these states.
So the very first state that you polled was Colorado. You held focus groups there as well. What did you learn from those?
Well, so a lot of times with in research, when you just do quantitative studies, you learn a lot about the what. But you don't learn a lot about the why behind a lot of these answers. So in Colorado with these focus groups, the tremendous benefit that we got was the emotion behind these issues. And, you know, while there may be other issues that folks see as more important to them, like, you know, maybe like healthcare or the economy, what we learned in these focus groups was that if public lands are threatened, people on both sides of the aisle really get ramped up really quickly, and they want to they want to protect and defend their public lands. And you really learn the emotion behind that and the focus groups that you don't get in a survey.
So there seems to be an assumption in some circles that conservation issues are primarily a liberal or a democratic issue. Did that prove true throughout this polling?
No. In fact, quite the opposite, especially, you know, when talking specifically about public lands. Public lands are really a bipartisan issue. And whether you're talking about, you know, access or development, the people on both sides of the aisle, and particularly in the middle, really want to strike a balance there. Republicans and Democrats alike want to protect their public lands. But the definition of protect, they might have a little bit of a difference there. When you get and you start to look at other kinds of voters, maybe primary voters, for example, who tend to be more extreme within their parties, that's where you start to see the more of a split between the parties, where you might have some Republicans proposing more extreme views, like selling off public lands to, especially on the national stage, to balance the budget, that kind of a thing. I mean, to reduce the deficit. Whereas on the Democratic side, you might have restricting access or restricting development to keep all resources in the ground, and that what we found is that that when you move more to the general election and those voters, in terms of trying to build your base and grow your base of support outside of those primary voters, those extreme positions just don't work.
So if a consultant or campaign manager comes to you and says, all right, I've got these swing voters in my state, in my district, what is it that they prioritize or they want to hear regarding the outdoors?
They want to see they definitely want to see protection and ensuring that those lands are there for future generations. But they also want to see access. They want to be able to these voters want to be able to access the land in order to enjoy them and share them with their families and future generations. And they want to continue to foster that connection between the lands and the economy. So, but in a balanced way, with even Republicans agree, with some additional protections to ensure the lands remain protected. Including development of alternative energy sources like solar and that kind of a thing on public lands. People were very receptive to those kinds of proposals.
So along those lines, in terms of balance, I want to talk about energy specifically. Didn't seem to be as much of a difference as someone might expect between Republican, Democrat, and swing voters.
No, that's true. That's very true. However, there were some slight differences. So there's definitely support for renewables. The renewable support is stronger on the left than it is on the right, but there's definitely support there for renewables. On the right hand side, more with Republicans, they still support coal and natural gas, whereas Democrats a little bit less. But you're right. The overall support for energy and energy development was strong. And again, I think that's very much connected to the linkage that people see to these public lands and their own state's economy.
So how have we seen these issues playing out across the West so far this cycle?
Well, looking at the Republican primaries, you know, we had a candidate in Ted Cruz who was talking about issues like selling off public lands to reduce the deficit. The public lands issues have been really top of mind in a couple of the states that we were polling in. So in the Montana governor's race, you've got the incumbent governor and the Republican challenger, both sort of trying to outposition them each other on access issues, and that's definitely been front and center. Also in Montana, there's been another race, congressional race, where the candidates are accusing one another of not being strong on public lands, and the Democrat is accusing the Republican of wanting to sell off public lands. And these are issues that really we haven't seen as much in the past come to the forefront. In Colorado, same kind of a thing in the Colorado 3rd District, where you've got a Republican incumbent and a Democratic challenger, and they're both fighting with each other back and forth over the importance of public lands, and that issue of selling it off, and access has come up as well. So these are real issues, and in these swing states, there are issues that these voters are paying attention to.
All right. So without violating any secrecy clauses here, revealing specific clients, do you know if the results from these polls inform the advice candidates are getting from any firms?
Well, that's hard to that's actually hard to quantify. So I don't know. I certainly hope that they're listening to us, and that they're reading the materials from this important campaign, because this campaign really does provide a recipe to candidates on how to sort of thread the needle with on public lands issues and increase their base of support regardless of party, because a lot of times these issues really are nonpartisan, so and they really should be nonpartisan. So a smart candidate would look at this this campaign, and for the folks that are looking online at the materials, we actually have a candidate cheat sheet where they can go in the back of the PowerPoint that tells them candidates on both sides of Republicans and Democrats what issues work for them and what don't, and sort of within their own party how to thread that needle and increase their base of support on these issues.
All right. Since we've got you here, since we are so close to the election, I want to pick your brain, stepping away from winning the West for a second. So we are inundated with polling right now, a week from Election Day. When you see polls come in, how do you sort out the good from the bad?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And, as a consultant and someone, I don't currently work directly with political campaigns any longer, but I always value the data coming out of the campaign itself a little bit more than some of these public polls, because the campaigns have actual skin in the game, and so to me those polls can be a little more credible, and there's a little bit more to that than meets the eye. So most campaigns, when they survey, actually purchase voter files, and they're talking to folks who are registered voters. But on that file, you can see how likely that person is to vote in terms of their vote history. And there are different assumptions that pollsters make on that. But the bottom line is it's real. And as long as you talk to that person on the file, you know who you're talking to, and that you're actually talking to a likely voter. A lot of the public polls actually go out and you use something called RDD, random digit dialing, where they ask people how likely they are to vote and ask people if they're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. And the bottom line on that is sometimes people lie and they're not as truthful. So that methodology isn't necessarily as reliable or as trusted as actually surveying directly off of a voter file. And then there are other polls that are publicly released that are strictly online. Those, while online polls are certainly coming along and they're widely accepted in the accepted in the corporate world, in the political world, I don't know if they're all there yet. The most likely voters are still the older generations, and those folks are less likely to take, at least in voter circles, to participate in these online polls. So there's just a lot to sort of factor in when you're looking at all these public polls. So one of the things that I recommend, I'm not plugging anybody or anything, but Real Clear Politics, for example, sort of aggregates all these polls, and they have an average. And so I think that's probably the best way for people to sort of decipher what's going on, is to sort of take all of the numbers that you see and average them, and then somewhere in there is where the truth lies.
The modeling that we're seeing this cycle from 538, the Upshot, the New York Times, you a fan of those sorts of models, or you think just take the straight average and just go from there?
Well, whenever you have a model, you're making an assumption. And so those assumptions can be, you can be lucky and you can be right on or not. So, yeah, I mean, I think they're interesting. I still, sort of want to err on the side of conservatism in terms of who's right. And I think the answer really does lie somewhere in these averages. You bring up a good point about these models. So you have to, when you have an election poll, you have to figure who is going to actually turn out on election day, right? So if you think it's going to be, Democrats are going to be more energized, you might have more Democrats in your model and fewer Republicans. And then at the end of the day, when you get your data in, you need to weight that data to what that model looks like. If you're wrong, then in terms of your model and those assumptions that you're making around what election day looks like, that just sort of skews your results, which is what happened to Republicans in the past two cycles with Obama. The Obama campaign was brilliant in terms of turning out minorities and millennials at higher numbers than Republicans ever thought. I'm a Republican pollster, and we kind of got caught where we were giving the Obama campaign and the Democrats many more millennials and minorities than we thought were even possible. He still blew us out of the water, so blew our model up. So I think at the end of the day, looking at these averages is still probably the best way.
All right, last question. It's after Election Day. 1 week, 2 week, 3 weeks out from here, one of the most polarizing presidential elections, obviously, we've seen in a generation or two. If you could run any question, any poll past the American people after this election, what would you want to know?
I think I want to know what most Americans want to know is what the heck just happened? I mean, how did we end up where we are? That would be the question, some sort of question around what happened. And if I had the liberty of asking, another question, this is more of a focus group question. How do we get out of this? What do we do better next time? I've always been one to say that, if you're complaining about what we have in our political system, then the best way to fix that is to register and get out and vote. And I still believe that, even though, the Trump campaign did a great job in getting more people to turn out in Republican primaries than in the past. There's still a lot more room to grow, and there's a lot of people that could still come out in both parties and vote in the primaries, and that would really help, I think, to solve part of the problem. The other part of the problem is getting the right people to run for office. And so, in this day and age of the 24-hour news cycle and social media, there are a lot of people that are sort of staying away from running for office who might, maybe 20 years ago or more might have considered it. And I think we need to encourage more people to run for office to give us more choice. So the combination of those two things. But I do think that there's some really interesting research questions about, what happened and how do we fix it?
All right. Brian Gottlieb, Managing Director of Purple Insights, talking about the Center for Western Priorities winning the West polls and the bigger picture here in 2016. You can find a link to those polls and clips from those focus groups that we talked about. That link's in the show notes or at westernpriorities.org/winningthewest. Brian, thank you again for your time today.
Thank you very much.
We are going to wrap up with a look back at the stories that made the West what it is today. This week in Western history, in 1864, four gold miners struck it rich at the Last Chance Gulch in Montana. That is where they founded the town of Helena. Miners dug up $19 million worth of gold in the next 4 years. The gold in Last Chance Gulch dried up, but Helena went on to become the capital of Montana 30 years later. Also this week, Nevada became the 36th state on October 31st, 1864. Usually, Congress required a territory to have 60,000 residents before allowing statehood. Nevada only had 40,000 at the time. But President Lincoln was trying to pass the 13th Amendment banning slavery. He knew the territorial officials in Nevada were strong supporters of his, and he wanted Nevada's support in the presidential election, which was just a week away. So with time running short, the Nevada delegation sent what was at the time the longest telegram ever transmitted, the entire text of the proposed state constitution. It cost them $3,400 to send it from Nevada to D.C. That's about 50 grand in today's money. Nevada became a state, Lincoln was reelected, and the 13th Amendment was ratified the next January. Well, that's it for the very first edition of Go West Young Podcast. If you like what you heard here, please leave us a review on iTunes. It is the easiest way for folks to discover what we're doing here. You can also find us on TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Google Play. If you have comments, questions, ideas, or people you think we should talk to, please drop us an email. podcast@westernpriorities.org is the address. My name is Aaron Weiss. We will be back after the election with more episodes. Thanks for listening.